So, before the break, you were talking about fostering engagement in the classroom and how that is part of being an effective teacher. And it occurred to me that this might also encompass giving students the autonomy to do things that are creative in the classroom, because if people are creating things, then they're generally engaged. So you've touched upon this yourself, and I read a quote where you said, "Creativity is an elusive concept to define." From your work on this area, what advice can you give to teachers who want to become more creative in the classroom?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think, first of all, you need to unpack creativity a bit. And I think you need to think of your teaching and learning objectives. I find it useful to draw on the distinction made by Anna Kraft in the literature between creative teaching on the one hand and teaching for creativity on the other. Mm-hmm. In other words, are you looking to use creative, imaginative approaches to make your teaching more interesting and effective, or are you looking to develop your learners' creative thinking and behaviour? The answer may well be both, and of course there's overlap between the two, but I think it's important to think about what our intentions are. And in the case of creative teaching, in other words, using imaginative approaches to make your lessons more interesting, I think as a rule of thumb, it's always a good idea to think of what you always do and either turn it upside down or do the opposite. So, for example, if you usually tell a story from beginning to end, why not start with the middle? And students have to predict what happened before and after that moment in the story. Or, for example, if you ask students to summarise a story in two or three paragraphs, why not do them the opposite and give them a story in tweet or telegraphic form and ask them to expand it? I think also it's important for us to remember that our lessons don't have to be a kind of creative fireworks show for its own sake. And in fact, that can sometimes have a negative effect anyway, because it makes the students kind of passive receivers of watching this amazingly creative teacher, but not necessarily produce learning. And I also often say to teachers, you know, try being creative in small ways. For example, with children lining up. You know, children have to line up so many times during the school day. Mm. Why not think of little creative ways of doing it? In order of height, in alphabetical order of names, order of months of your birthday, for example. And other things that you can introduce creative ideas, such as learning routines. You know, have different kinds of action lines or a circle time where students give you news of the day and so on. I also think it's a good idea, I think, to have creative ideas up your sleeve. You know, things like, I use things like spelling gym or little action rhymes or lateral thinking riddles or puzzles, little creative ideas that you can do at odd moments. When you feel maybe that the class is flagging, that the mood needs changing and lifting. And Jerome Bruner, he talks about creativity in a teaching context, creativity being the ability to create an effective surprise. So actually for us to think about how we can make sure that every lesson is an effective surprise. And the reason I love that definition is not just a surprise for its own sake, but one that is also effective in achieving desired learning outcomes too. And I think, so that's on one side. And then if we're looking at teaching for creativity, in other words, developing our students' ability to think creatively, empowering them to be creative, then I think fundamental is to build up positive self-esteem and also a growth mindset that I was talking about earlier, so that our learners have the confidence to take risks. And then, you know, creativity always arises from something. It never occurs in a vacuum. So we need to provide a stimulus and a framework and a purpose. Why are we doing this? I think also very often adopting an inclusive approach in which students co-participate and co-create with each other as well as you. Crucially, I think also is for us to consider the way that we use questions and what kind of questions we use. Questions that challenge learners' thinking and lead to higher order thinking rather than the kinds of questions, the kind of display questions that are closed questions and closed down thinking. And also, of course, you know, giving children time to answer questions and encouraging them to ask their own questions, which is an incredibly invaluable way of learning. I think the other thing, of course, is to, wherever we can, encouraging children to make connections between English and their own language, between their culture and English culture, across disciplines, finding links between ideas, objects, subjects, anything. You know, a kind of activity, simple activity where you have a feely bag with either different objects in or words on cards, and students have to take three and make a connection between them. But that making those connections is a significant part of learning how to be a creative thinker.
Very much so. Speaking of activities, I wanted to move on and have a look. You wrote a book called 500 Activities for the Primary Classroom, an incredibly popular title. And I wanted to ask you what you put that book's popularity down to.
Well, thank you. It's funny, actually, because in a way I think of that book as a compendium of my life as a teacher. And when I wrote it, the ideas just kept coming and coming. And actually, my editors at the time very kindly agreed to an increase in the extent from the original plan of about 192 pages to well over 300. Mm. And I think it's popular partly because it gives instant recipes of things that you can take in and do in class on Monday morning. But I think also it's because it's more than that and actually invites teachers to think creatively and critically and come up with their own creative variations for the activities. So in that way, it's much more than a recipe book and develops teachers' competence and confidence in coming up with the recipes themselves. And people have told me that they also use it on teacher education courses. And I think that's because the introduction to each chapter gives an accessible rationale of the theory underpinning the use of different kinds of activities, storytelling, drama, songs, and so on. And there are also questions to promote reflective practice at the end of each chapter, which trainers can use to encourage teachers to evaluate different kinds of classroom activities, the learners' responses, and their own performance as teachers. I guess also, although it's called 500 Activities for the Classroom, when you actually take into account the variations and options, there are actually far more than 500. And I also know that a lot of teachers use the activities when working with lower secondary children as well. So I guess it's, you know, the number and range of activities, but also the range of ages that it appeals to as well.
Absolutely, very wide-ranging. I'm sure a lot of teachers who are listening have used it, and those who haven't will want to use it now. And finally, I wanted to ask you, you've been in the industry for over 30 years now, and I wondered how things have changed in that time, and if there's anything that you predict will change in the next couple of years in primary teaching.
Well, primary teaching and teacher education, and I actually recently wrote an article about that for the 30th anniversary edition of the IATEFL YLT SIG newsletter, which can actually be downloaded from my website if people are interested. Mm-hmm. And I think the key changes I'd flag up are, first of all, the drive to lower the age of starting English as a foreign language globally. And first of all, you know, that was to introduce it in the first year of primary school, but increasingly these days to introduce it in preschool as well. I think, and this is very good news, that there has been in recent years a great increase in research into children's learning a foreign language in school context. And this contributes to our knowledge and understanding about what is effective. For example, just to mention one, Janet Enova's ELLIE project, which is a longitudinal study in a range of European countries and provides invaluable evidence-based guide to the positive outcomes of starting early as well as the pitfalls. I think other things we've seen are the introduction of CLIL, so content and language integrated learning, in many contexts. And that also, I think, has had a very positive knock-on effect on general English courses, which now include far more cross-curricular material than they ever used to.
Mm-hmm.
I think also there's an increased awareness, understanding and implementation of areas that go beyond just language teaching. So things such as values education, teaching children life skills and intercultural competence. And I guess another thing, of course, to mention is the move towards digital materials, although this does vary hugely in different contexts. And perhaps one last thing to mention is there is these days far greater awareness and understanding of different special educational learner needs and diversity and the importance of access to learning and engagement and participation for all. Prediction for next 2 years. Well, next 2 years, not very long, but I think, first of all, the trend to lower the age will continue by popular demand and, I would add, despite all the health warnings and uncertain benefits of that that we know from research. But parents are determined that their children will learn English younger and younger, and so those kind of policies will continue to be implemented. I would also like to predict that the quality of provision will continue to improve as we understand more about children's foreign language learning from the increased amount of research. And I also think, of course, that the publishing drive from print to digital will continue, although not necessarily in a straightforward way, as I also see in some contexts, they may well be a backlash, or perhaps that's too strong a word, but against that, because I do think there are genuine worries and concerns about the negative effect of too much screen time for young children, and there's a lot of research on that, particularly coming out of the States. And also, in general terms, research has so far produced quite mixed results as to what extent the use of technology makes a difference to children's learning. So yes, I think that will definitely continue. More teachers will become, especially those teachers who have learnt English using technology themselves. As that generation grows up and becomes teachers, we will see digital materials used far more, but it won't be, it's something that will vary very much in different contexts.
Absolutely. And I think obviously technology in the end is just going to supplement teaching rather than replace the teaching, hopefully. And there'll still be people using wonderful books like your 500 activities. Well, Carol, thank you very much. It's been fascinating to speak to you.
Well, thanks, Patrick. It's been great to be here.
Absolutely. And very, very briefly, what's next for you this year? Have you got any plans in the pipeline?
I've got lots of plans in the pipeline. I'm kind of entering a new phase since I stepped down last year from my role as president of IATEFL.
Mm-hmm.
I now have a lot more time for doing consultancies and writing. So I've got quite a few exciting projects in the pipeline, yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks. Brilliant. Excellent. Well, best of luck with those. And thank you again for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure to be here. Real pleasure.
Pleasure to have you too. Take care and have a nice summer.
Thanks. Bye.
Cheers,
then.
Bye.